strange.
Yeah, hard to remember. Well, it's on the outside, too. Yeah. That's a bigger issue. You have to go all the way outside to change it.
Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvi Navatitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Oh, here they are. I thought I forgot my glasses. That would be require a trip to my room. Okay, let's do this. What number 29?
29.
Te parag darshina pratyak.
Tattva bodha vivarjitaha.
Tattva bodha vivarjitaha.
Kurvate karma bhogaya.
Kurvate karma bhogaya.
Karma kartuncha bhunjate.
Karma kartuncha bhunjate.
Natyankita iva vartat.
Natyankita iva vartat.
Avartantaramu. Avartantaram ashute.
Avartantaram ashute.
Rajanto janmano janma.
Rajanto janmano janma.
Labhante naiva nirvrittim.
Labhante naiva nirvrittim.
Next two we might as well. Do the next two and we might get that far. Yeah.
Sat karma paripakate.
Sat karma paripakate.
Karuna nidhino dhrta.
Karuna nidhino dhrta.
Prapyati rattaruchayam.
Prapyati rattaruchayam.
Vishramyanti yatha sukham.
Vishramyanti yatha sukham.
Upadesham avapyayvam.
Upadesham avapyayvam.
Acharya tattva darshinaha.
Acharya tattva darshinaha.
Panchakosha vivekena.
Panchakosha vivekena.
Labhante nirvrittim param.
Labhante nirvrittim param.
So this is just a short section on the plight of the Taijasas, Taijasaha. Yeah, the Taijas, she's the plight of the Vishwatam. Like the Taijasas, they take a physical form, either as a devata or a human being, or what's the other one they have here, human being or an animal. Tiryak means one that's on four legs. The four-leggeds, all the four-leggeds. The devatas, the higher lokas, more subtle bodies. And then also the human beings, but all forms, you know, all bodies that take a sukshma sharira, subtle body. You know, those are all taijases that have become vishwa, means they're now embodied in a physical form. And they find themselves embodied now, these jivas in full, jivas are now in full form, they've got their physical body, you know. They have a problem. And the problem is this, it says, te parak darshinaha. All of these vishwas, all of these embodied jivas, te parak darshinaha, they are all looking outward. Their vision is all external. This, if I have my sense organs, it's not our fault, really. Because all of our pramanas, all of our sense organs are focused outward. They don't turn around and look at the self. They don't have that capacity. You know, even the mind has many capacities, like in meditative states, imagination, imaginal states, all different types of memories, emotions, all kinds of different states. You know, but those states are all illumined by consciousness. The mind as a faculty can't go like this. It doesn't have a 360 degree, you know, turntable. Like it can go in any direction. It doesn't. We make it go in that direction. We direct it toward that. But, you know, it's even a bigger problem like that than that. The vrittis and the content of the vrittis in the mind, for the jiva, because of ajnanam, they belong to the mind. They are experiences that the mind is having, because the self, you know, from the standpoint of the mind, the self is superimposed on the mind. So there, the self has its own ahankara, I notion. And so what that means is that the mind takes on the knowership, because it's sattva, the mind takes on the self and takes itself to be a knower. So consciousness, you know, reflected or enjoyed by the self, but enjoyed by the mind, is, in language, becomes a knower in order to differentiate it from the known. So if you think about it, every vritti that you have, the content of every vritti that you have is illumined by consciousness and is therefore known. Now you don't have a ahankara landing on those objects, like the room or like any of you. My ahankara doesn't, my anish doesn't land on you. It lands here, in this case, on me, the mind, who knows you. So that means that the sattva, which reflects consciousness, is part of the experience of the mind. Part of the experience of the mind is consciousness and the object of consciousness. I am the consciousness. But if the I am, the one who is the consciousness, is taken to be part of the mind, then I have to differentiate myself from the content of the mind in terms of a subject-object relationship. So I identify with a consciousness in the mind, and the objects of consciousness, I take them to be known. So I'm labeled as the knower, and the objects of consciousness are labeled as the known. And so this dichotomy is set up like this. But in fact, if we analyze it a little bit more deeply, which they're not doing in this verse, because as we see, they're like little worms drowning in the ocean. So from the standpoint of ajnanam, we stop at the knower known. But if we analyze the nature of the object, we could say this is object consciousness. And then analyze the nature of the knower, and we would say this is knower consciousness. So, in fact, both the knower and the known are illumined by consciousness. That's what we don't do. That's what the mind can't do. And that's why that ahankara is so firmly in place there. So now, the understanding that, now imagine having, because you're a meditator, and you know how to absorb the mind, and you have a wonderful, very, very blissful, totally absorbed, you forget the bliss, just say like this, you have a nirvikalpa samadhi, where in that state there is no experience at that time of subject-object, of knower-known. So you have this experience of just pure conscious being. And you do it because you know how to meditate, or you've taken drugs, or you've done something. You've done pranayama that takes you into that state. So now you have that state. It lasts for however long it lasts. It could be 3 seconds, or it could be an hour, or whatever. That state lasts for a certain amount of time, and then the mind again becomes extrovert. Right? Doesn't hold it forever. It comes out of that state. Now that it's out of that nirvikalpa, that non-dual state, what does it say? It says, I had this nirvikalpa state where there was no duality. I just abided as my experience was just non-dual me, without any differentiation, just non-dual consciousness. Right? Now I say, I had that state of non-dual consciousness. How can I get that back? How can I keep that state a little bit longer? You know? What was it that actually let me go into that profound level of absorption? So who's the I there? The I is the ahankara. Because the ajnanam has not been removed by an experience. You have an experience of non-duality. That experience is wonderful, and so that's perhaps a new experience, a wonderful experience. But it doesn't differentiate, it doesn't do anything to this anyonya adyasa, this mutual superimposition. So the ahankara remains intact, in place, because you've had an experience and now the experience is gone, which is true. If you have a nirvikalpa experience, that's because the mind has gone into a deep state of absorption so that there's no subject-object experience there, which is wonderful, you know, but there's no knowledge involved. And so you have this non-dual experience, and then you come back. The jnanam has not been removed. Self-ignorance has not been removed. And so you come back to exactly what you were before. The mind now has had this very profound, you know, life-changing experience. But you're still the mind. That is the problem. There's no way for this mind to turn itself around. Let's put it this way. It has no pramana that goes in this direction. There's no pramana, there's no means of knowledge that can make sense of, give me knowledge of my experience. I can have the experience. In fact, honestly, we are having the experience all of the time of this world, which is Ishvara, of this self, which is Brahman. We're never not having these experiences. We have the experience of prana, we have the experience of the mind, we have the experience of the types of thoughts, we have the experience of the sense organs. What experience don't we have? So the problem is not one of experience, it's one of knowledge. What is this experience? What really is this experience? What in truth is this experience? And what is the relationship of this extrovert, objectifiable experience to me? Who am I in reference to all of these experiences? Who am I in reference to this nirvikalpa samadhi? Because the ajnanam has not been removed. And so here, this is the problem. So he says, all of the jivas, now as Vishwa, all of them are looking outward. Why? Pratyaktatva bodha vivarjitaha. Because they are not, they are, vivarjita means without. So they are vivarjitaha, but without the knowledge of the truth, which is pratyak, innermost. When we say truth, you have to, there's many ways of defining truth. So we have to remember, when we're saying something is true, what we mean is that it's not mithya. Being true means that it is what we call satyam. Means it's something that actually is. It has being of its own accord. It's not depending upon something else for being. It is the being, right? And so that's the definition of satyam. That is the truth. That is the reality. So we're using it. That's how we use the word truth. Truth means it's something that cannot be negated in past, present, and future. Something that is its existence is independent, not depending on anything else. It's self-shining. The whole world, nothing can do anything about that. That's what we mean by satyam, or what is the tattva. Another way to understand tattva is that tva affix shows the ness of something, the nature of something. So if we take, they use this pronoun tat, which means that. So that. All pronoun, the pronoun can land on anything. So say the pronoun tut can land on anything in the creation, on any level of the creation. So what is the ness of that? What is the reality of that? That is the tattva. What is the essence of that? And that stands for everything in the creation. What is the essence of that? That is the tattva. And that tattva is pratyak. How can you find it? Not by looking outward. Not by any type of objectification. Anything that can be objectified is namarupa. That's the limitation of our sense organs, name and form. Name and form has to have a substance. And when we try to look for the substance, all we can get, because of the limitation of our sense organs, are smaller names and forms. Yeah. And then we analyze the smaller names and forms, then our sense organs only allow us to give us smaller names and forms. If we were to see the substance, the being, the ness of it all, you have to remove the name and form. And you can't see that. They remove all the names and forms, and you have your sense organs, and they're looking, and there's just nothing there to see. There's only something to be. You remove all names and forms, and either there's cannot be, I'll say it like this, there cannot be non-existence there, or you couldn't experience anything, because it's not there to be experienced. So you have to, if you think of removing all names and forms, you have to get to the substance of every name and form. See, if you remove all names and forms, because just think about it, here, like this is one room full of people, okay, but then it's not one thing here. This isn't an entity. It's a conglomerate. And so this is very obvious that we're all kind of different, you know, different nama-rupas. But if you take one form and take the form off it, what do you have? If you're analyzing through your sense organs, you have many smaller names and forms because that's the best you can do. You know? And then you analyze those, you have smaller names and forms. How to gain knowledge of the substance. And the substance, not just of one name and form, but of all names and forms. But if we understand that, how that must be, because if it's any name and form, you're looking outward. And that's what your sense organs can give you. So it can't be some knowledge that your sense organs are giving you. It has to be the essence of what your sense organs are giving you. Yeah. Now, the good thing about that is that you're all nama-rupas, you're all names and forms, and I'm name and form, but we're lucky to be name and forms to be as conscious beings. We're lucky to be have these nama-rupas because I can go into the pratyagatma, the innermost, not through, only up to a point through using my mind and sense organs, but then what is as though behind or essential to those sense organs is me. And I am not non-existent, but I'm not an object of sense perception. But I am not non-existent. I am an existent being. And this existent being that is me, we always take for granted, of course. But you take yourself for granted because you're always here. Why wouldn't you take yourself for granted? You are the one thing that is always here. And so you trust it completely. You're worried about maybe dying or you don't like to be, you know, have certain types of emotions and all of that. But you're not going, ooh, I'm going to disappear, like everything else. You don't feel like that, you know. I'm thinking, but in the next thought I might not be here anymore. We don't think like that, you know, and in fact, because that never even occurs to us in that way, we don't worry about the fact that every single experience in inner and outer is leaving us. It comes and it goes, it comes and it goes. You think you would freak out. If any of that, if you had a real identification with any of that, what would happen to you when it goes? You would be gone. Well, we never worry about it because we've never had such an experience because myself, the me, is constant. The problem is, I don't really know that. I don't know that. I only know the constant nature of myself from the standpoint of all of the moods and the emotions and the perceptions I'm having, all the experiences, inner and outer experiences. I only recognize my presence, the me in all of those experiences, but all of those experiences are changing, so I don't say that I'm going into non-existence, I say I'm always changing. And that's a very disturbing recognition that you are always changing. Your thoughts are always changing, your emotions are always changing, your desires are always changing. You know, and it won't ever stop. It always changes. Because that's the nature of samsara. That's the nature of the creation. But when you start really realizing that, I mean, what are you going to do? You have to become a mumukshu to start figuring out, well, who am I who's having all these experiences? Which is much different than saying, I am happy. I am sad. I am in a relationship. I am not in a relationship. You know, I am this, I am that, I am this, I am that, I am this, I am that. Ah. It's better to know who you are and then have all these experiences. Mm-hmm. Wear all of these different costumes and dresses, and that's okay, but you are there. And so the whole knowledge is, you know, we need this pramana. We need this pramana so that I can know who I am, the one who's here, you know, period, as all these experiences are coming and going. So he says, you know, these vishwas, these jivas have a problem. They're all looking outward. And why? Because they don't have any means of knowledge at all to know, to have knowledge of the truth, which is innermost to everything. Pratyak. Like the pratyagatma. What do they say? Pratyagatma means the innermost self. It's because of the upadis. You take this to be yourself. You take the sense organs to be yourself. You take the prana to be yourself. You take the fluctuating mind to be yourself. You take the buddhi to be yourself. You take the emotions to be yourself. You take, so there's a gradation going inward, 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 that we call the panchakoshas that go in, until you can't go any farther. If you go any farther, then there's only you there. These things are no longer a kosha. Once you go in, and you get to the anandamaya kosha, and you differentiate that, then there's only you left. That's why these panchakoshas are important, because you can differentiate yourself from them. So, this problem they have of looking outward, only looking outward and not being able to know the self, causes some problems. And the second line, kurvate karma bhogaya karma kartum chabunjate. So, being ones that can only look outward, it says, they, kurvate karma, they perform karmas. We all perform karmas. We do actions in order to enjoy the result. It says, bhogaya, for our enjoyment. We do this karma because we have some sort of karma pola in mind. You don't just do a karma, you know. Yeah, why are you doing this karma? Well, I'm just doing it, you know. You always know, even if it's going to get a drink of water or to sit down and be comfortable. Why are you sitting down? I'm tired. I just want to sit and relax. That's why. So I can just rest for a minute. That's the pola. That's the type of enjoyment. That's the experience I'm looking. When you say bhoga, it means enjoyment. But actually, what is the experience you're looking for by doing this particular karma? You know? That's a really interesting question, especially as for mumukshu, as you're getting knowledge. Like, why am I doing this karma? Why am I doing this activity? Why am I engaged in this? Because we don't just do karmas for nothing, you know? As a mumukshu, you can say, I'm doing this karma, or I'm behaving in this way for antakarna shuddhi. That's why you're doing it. That's a good reason to do something. You're doing it in order to work with your mind so that it learns how to gain shanti. That's why I'm doing this. That's why I'm working. I'm working on myself. Why are you working on myself, on yourself? Well, because I want to have the antakarna shuddhi. I want to have a mind that has a natural shanti. And these are different ways that I can work on gaining that. So that's always, we don't just do karma. We do karma for a reason. Now then, another thing is, there's another way to take this line. It's sort of, it'll go like this, what I'm saying, and then it says, karma kartum chabunjate. And then we enjoy those karma polas to do other karmas. You know, enjoy that karma to do another karma. So another way to take that, which to take it in both ways in this commentary, is as a Hindu, part of the Vedic cult, being contained in the Vedic culture, I do karmas. I do rituals. I do what we call the required required rituals that they call the Nitya Naimittika karmas. I do all those karmas, those rituals that are asked of me to do on a daily basis or on an occasional basis if I do a papa, I do a prayasthita karma, a certain karma to neutralize the bad effects of that karma. I give dhanam. Dhanam means gifts. I give charities. I always welcome guests as they come. I always have an extra meal that's been prepared. You know, if somebody shows up at dinner time, I always welcome them and the etiti, the way we treat the etitis, our guests, and make them very comfortable. That's an important dharma. So all of these karmas that are enjoined karmas, I do all of those for what? So kurvate karma, I perform all of these karmas, bhogaya, for the result of that karma. And what are the results of these karmas? It's usually we're looking at the adrishta karmas. I do all of these for the adrishta punya, for punya, that will then bless me to get a better next birth. Or if I've done a lot of karmas like upasanas and, you know, various austerities and things like that, and meditations, I'm doing all of these karmas so that I can go to Swargaloka and get a body, a very subtle body in Swargaloka, and sit down and gain knowledge from Brahmaji, Swamiji always. I'll sit down and gain some knowledge from Brahmaji. Swamiji says, yeah, but you could gain it here. Why are you going to go through all of that? I want to gain the knowledge from Brahmaji. I want to experience the Swargaloka. And so that's why I spend day after day, almost all day long, totally devoted to these karmas that will accrue enough punya so that I can go to Swargaloka, so that I can meet Brahmaji and have all of the ananda that comes from that particular loka. That's why I'm doing the karmas. Okay, so you do all of those karmas to get the bhoga, the reward of those, the enjoyment of the fruit, to get enough fruit, the bhoga, the fruit of those karmas. And then you say, and then you enjoy that fruit, which is really in the form of another body. You enjoy that fruit in the form of a better body, you know, or a better loka. So you enjoy that to do what? To do more karmas. To continue doing karmas. You know? Like say you're doing karmas to have certain experiences. Now you're having those experiences because now you're embodied to have those experiences. And so now having those experiences and being embodied, you do more karmas. This is what they call samsara. You know, because in the sense that it keeps you in the system. You do all of this work, all of these karmas to get a better body. You get the better body to do what? To continue to do karmas. Which will do what? It will give you another body that you can enjoy in order to do what? To continue doing karmas. That's the samsara chakra. You don't get a body and then just sit there like a stone or something. You know? You're now in this world again, or get have some experiences in higher lokas, more subtle lokas. Then you come back, here you are, you know, with a nice body. As long as, truly, a nice body. That's why you have to do all the good karmas to accrue the punya, so that you will get a better body, a good body, that will, and good experiences. Here in this loka, it's 50-50. But you can have a good body, you can have a good mind, one that is available for you to gain moksha. You know? But anyway, this is the samsara chakra. You know? You do these karmas to gain a better body, you gain a better body, you do the karmas, it goes on and on and on like that. So that's a good way of interpreting this particular verse. So in other words, you're stuck because of not having self-knowledge, you're stuck in the samsara chakra. Chakra means wheel. This wheel of samsara. Birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. And your karmas keep you in it. In that way, punya itself is considered a bondage, not just papa. Punya and papa are both bondage because they keep you in the samsara chakra. You know, you may have a better body and better circumstances, but you're still in samsara. So in that way, from that vantage point, both punya and papa are bondages because of the trap that you fall into, which is now this nice verse. So repeat after me. Let me just go over a little bit.
Can we maybe turn on the light?
Mm-hmm. Oh, is there a light?
Yeah, there is.
You ready?
Yeah. For the blast off. Okay. Oh, I can see. I can see the book. Okay, so repeat it for me. Nadyam.
Nadyam.
Kitaha.
Kitaha.
Eva.
Eva.
Avartat.
Avartat.
Avartantaram.
Avartantaram.
Ashu.
Ashu.
Te. Vrajantaha.
Vrajantaha.
Janmanaha.
Janmanaha.
Janma.
Janma.
Labhante.
Labhante.
Na eva.
Na eva.
Nirvritim.
Nirvritim.
So here it says, there's a drishtanta, an illustration now, and then they'll give the darshtanta after. Okay, so where's the drishtanta illustration? It says, nedyam kitaha eva. Eva means like. Like kitas. Kitas are worms. Can also be insects, but usually they translate as worms. Just like some little worms, some little worms in a river. A river, it's a nadi pravaha, like a flowing river. So some little worms are trapped there in the flowing river. And what they do, that they find themselves, avartat, avartantaram, ashute vrijantaha. They find themselves moving quickly. So that's the ashu means quickly, te means they. Vrijantaha. They are moving, so these little worms, they're moving very quickly from whirlpool to whirlpool. So avarta, and avarta is a whirlpool. So here it says avartat, from one whirlpool, it's an ablative singular for Sanskrit people, avartantanam, to another whirlpool. So these little worms that are caught in a river find themselves moving very quickly with the flow of the water, getting caught in one whirlpool and then to another, moving from one whirlpool to another. And so, being in this situation, labhante naiva nirvritim, they don't gain any happiness. There's no sukha for them. No sukha. So labhante na eva nirvritim. They don't gain any really happiness because it lasts such a short period of time. They just get shot over into the next world. Okay. So that, and then it says, so just, let me just get rid of the idea here, and we'll see in the next verse. It's the idea is just as the Vishwas, in the same way the Vishwas go from birth to birth, just like these little worms, you know, going down the flow, the quickly moving river, find themselves in this whirlpool, this birth, and get cast into the next one, another whirlpool, into another one, into another one. Just like the jivas, the vishwas, the us, go from body to birth to birth to birth to birth, never finding any shanti, never finding any real happiness. Momentary shanti, but never, we need somehow to be put on the shore. We need to get onto the shore. So like that, going back to the going back in verse 31 to the drishtanta, it says, if you have to meet sat karma,
sat karma,
paripakat,
paripakat,
te, karuna,
karuna,
nidina,
nidina,
udrataha,
udrataha,
prapya,
prapya,
tira,
tira,
taru,
taru,
chayam,
chayam,
vishramyanti,
vishramyanti,
yathasukam,
yathasukam.
So it says, set karma paripakat. Paripaka means maturity. Say if you become a mature person, or say your karma is mature, ready to fructify. So what this says is, set karma paripaka, because of the maturing of your good karmas, means they're ready to come into manifestation. So because of the set karma paripaka, those worms, karuna nidina, by someone who is an ocean of compassion.
Right.
Karuna means compassion. The word nidhi means a reservoir. A big reservoir is a nidhi. So you can say we're ocean, or you can say they're just a huge reservoir of compassion. So by a person who's full of compassion, karuna nidhina, udrataha, those worms are picked up. Udrataha, they're picked up, they're rescued. They're picked up, they're rescued out of the water. So te means they are rescued by person because of the maturing of their good karma, their punya karma. They are they are pulled out of that water by a person who is a reservoir of compassion. Then, having been rescued, then prapya tira taru chayam. Then they are placed in the shade, the chaya, under the root of a tree. They're placed at the root of a tree, and so they're resting there. Under that, on the root, right at the root of the tree, taru, they're resting there under the root of a tree. Then what? Vishramyanti, they rest there happily. Yatasukam, it kind of says, as you can imagine, they might. As you can imagine how they would feel, the relief and the happiness and the fullness they would feel after having been pulled out of this, you know, these whirlpools and placed so gently there, in the shade under the tree. So as happy as you can imagine. Okay. So that's the drishtanta. Now, having established the whole story of the worms being rescued, now we have to get the darshtanta. You have to join it up to the darshtanta. And so the darshtanta is what this illustration is about. So it says, repeat after me, upadesham,
upadesham,
avapya,
avapya,
evam,
evam,
acharyat,
acharyat,
tattvadarshinaha,
tattvadarshinaha,
panchakosha,
panchakosha,
vivekena,
vivekena,
labante,
labante,
nirvritim,
nirvritim,
param,
param.
So here's the darshtanta, the act with the illustration is referring to. Give me an example. Upadesham avapya evam, in this manner, in this way of being rescued, so in this manner, like just like the little kitas were rescued. So in this way, having gained the teaching, the upadesha of the Upanishads and the Acharya, having gained avapya, having gained the upadesha, acharyat, from the acharya, from the teacher, who is a tattvadarshinaha, who themselves have this vision of the nature of the self, the nature of the pratyekatma, the nature of reality. So having gained the teaching in this manner from the acharya is the person. Often the acharyas are often likened to these karunanidhis, these beings that have an ocean of compassion. So Amaji will joke about this because from their standpoint, there's no problem. There is no problem at all. There's no problem. But you're having a problem. And since you're having a problem, I can free you of that problem in the same way my teacher freed me of that problem. So they're honored in that way. So having gained the teaching from an acharya, who themselves are tattvadarshinahas, they themselves have this knowledge. I mean, imagine having a teacher who doesn't have the knowledge. That's really awful. I don't know what they're teaching something. Okay. So Upadesha Avapya Avam Acharya Tattva Darshinaha. Darshina has in the fifth case also from seven from the teacher who themselves have this vision. And then it says Panchakosha Vivekena. Through the Viveka, Panchakosha Viveka, through this discrimination of the five sheaths, Labhante, they gain, they attain Nirvritim Param, that supreme ananda. They gain that supreme ananda, nirvritti, that supreme sukha, which is the very satchit ananda, the ananda of their own being, of themselves. So here, one thing is the use of this, we're doing Panchakosha Viveka. So Panchakosha Viveka, it's not just Panchakosha Viveka, but it is just Panchakosha Viveka. We have many prakriyas, the differentiating myself from these five sheaths that we've already learned. The physical body is Annamaya Kosha, right? The prana is Pranamaya Kosha, the pranas. Then the manas is Manomaya Kosha. And then the buddhi is Vijnanamaya Kosha. Then the ananda is Anandamaya Kosha. Each one of these sheaths is subtler than the other. So there's an order to them. Gaining viveka from each one of those, you end up gaining viveka from everything that you've ever objectified or taken to be yourself. And so if I say panchakosha viveka, through panchakosha viveka, one attains oneself, that panchakosha of viveka is accomplished in many ways. They're going to take us through panchakosha viveka once again, but then they move right into the Avastatraya Sakshi, being the witness of the three states of experience, waking, dream, and deep sleep. That's another prakriya. That prakriya frees you of all of these panchakoshas. You could say the panchakoshas, these five sheaths, they're also included and part of the stula, the physical body, the subtle body, and the causal body. The panchakosha viveka just cuts up the pie a little bit into five instead of three. But it just becomes you become more aware of all of the different levels of the upadis, which you are not. And so even now, if I move into the waking dream sleep state, that's also a panchakosha viveka, right? You're differentiating yourself from everything you can be without. And the waking state is negated by the dream state, is negated by the deep sleep state. All of the panchakoshas, all of the shariras, all of the ahankar, all points of identification are dismissed because you can be without them. So this is what the viveka is. The viveka is between your being and everything else you have mistakenly taken yourself to be. And so all of the prakriyas are giving this viveka. They're all about this viveka. You know, differentiating myself from the body, mind, sense organs, and differentiating myself from the whole universe. You know, if I can differentiate myself from the body, mind, sense organs, I then can differentiate myself from the entire universe. And so there are different prakriyas, different methodologies that allow us to do that. So that's why he points out panchakosha viveka, because panchakosha viveka negates everything that you are not, as does every single one of the prakriyas. Okay, that's what we have to understand. Mm-hmm. And so here it says that through that panchakosha viveka they obtain nirvritim param, that ananda, unsurpassable ananda. Remember, this param is feminine because nirvritti is feminine. So param. Para means, or parama or para, means desha, kala, vastu, or paricheta. It means it's an ananda, which is not our fullness, a happiness, that is not limited by the creation. Desha is space, kala is time, vastu is any type of object, or objectification is vastu, so, or thing, you know. So that ananda is not circumscribed, limited, or changed by the existence of space, by the existence of time, by the existence of objects. So that's an ananda that is not experienced in the world. It's only experienced in the world in a secondary way by gaining shanta vrittis, you know, silent, peaceful vrittis, through basically the fulfillment of a desire. You have to realize, we'll go over probably 100 times before this little course is over. But just because there's a trick, that is the grand illusion of samsara, that if I can have this, I will be happy. And it's a grand illusion because it works. If I get this object of desire, then I do experience ananda or happiness or joy, you know, or peace. I have all really positive experiences the moment I satisfy that desire, you know, that's priya moda pramoda. It's coming, I get happy, I see I'm going to get it, I become happy, very pleased, and I get it. Now it's secure, I'm so happy, and then I have the aftermath of that happiness, priya moda pramoda. So it works. That is the problem. It works, but not in the way that we think it works. It works because when you fulfill a desire, you get a shantavritti. Because only why do you get a shantavritti? Very simply, because at that moment you don't want anything. You've just fulfilled the desire. You need to give 15, 20 seconds or so before the next desire comes. So for a moment, you're like a jnani, like a mahatma, like somebody who just has this alam buddhi. No, would you like this? Do you need this? No, I don't need it. I'm fine. I'm fine just the way I am. Thanks. You know, no real desire is there, no binding desire. So just shantavritti. Now, when we, as samsaris, we fulfill a desire, what happens? We're desireless. For a short amount of time, we have a shantavritti. What happens when I have a shantavritti? I'm really happy. I'm really happy because that clean, clear mind, like a clean, clear water bucket reflecting the sun, that clean, clear mind resonates deeply with my own being. It's like who I am. It's like how the sun reflecting the clear water is resonating. You see the sun in that. You see that reflection. You see the sun there in the water. And so when my mind is calm, non-agitated, it's like a little crystal lake or something, it's just calm, then I experience ananda until the next desire comes or I become aware of the pratibandhakas, the obstructions that are going to get in my way and take this away from me or whatever it is. But I get that glimpse of ananda, and so does everybody else. It's not just me, it's everybody else. And so therefore it must be true. It must be true. It is true, but I have to know what actually is happening. The shantavritti that comes from the fulfillment of a desire is real. That is true. And it's also extremely temporary. And also, upon analysis, you realize that the ananda that you thought that object was giving you, it's not giving you anything. What's giving you something is the shantavritti, and you have the shantavritti because of your mistaken notion that that object that you now have is giving you the ananda. It has never given you any ananda, never at any time. But the attainment of that object and the shantavritti go together. And so you make me so happy. Or this accomplishment has made me so happy. But I don't just remain happy, you know. It's a false, it's an incredible, incredible illusion. And what makes it sadder, not sadder, but we have to understand it. It is kind of sad, but it's a little bit of sad side. We don't need any object at all to have a shantavritti. To have a peaceful mind, to have a quiet mind, that doesn't require a shantavritti. I mean, it doesn't require an object to give you that or the fulfillment desire to give you a shantavritti. You get shantavrittis in many different ways. Even a walk in nature gives you a shantavritti. You know? Just being with yourself gives you a shantavritti. Not wanting anything gives you a shantavritti. Knowing yourself, just being with ananda itself gives you a shantavritti. You know, you have many, many different types of shantapratis that are beyond even the fulfillment of a desire. But even those, taking a walk, I love nature so much because when I take a walk in nature, I just feel like myself. I feel one with Ishwara. Yeah, you have a tremendous shantapratti when you take a walk in nature. You know, smile of your child is for all of us, that parent, the child's parents, and all of us. And give us a smile. Shantapratti, ananda. So many things, but we need to know what's actually happening. What's actually happening is I have a shantapratti from one thing or another, or just from myself. Just knowing the source of the ananda. That's the big thing in terms of gaining self-knowledge. I know the source of the ananda. And so my mind rests in that ananda. And resting in that ananda, you know, experiences the world. And experiences the world as Ishwara, because resting in ananda, I don't need you to make me happy. I can be with you as you are. That's what is so great about Swamiji. Because so mature. He was so mature that he didn't require us to be in any particular way, you know, at all. It didn't make any difference since he was his own source of ananda. He wasn't looking to us to make him happy or anything, you know. And that was such a relief. And then I used to notice, well, not just me, but we all notice we're sitting in satsang, you know. We're sitting in satsang with 20, 30 people. We're sitting in satsang. He's just sitting there, he's reading the paper, or he's answering questions, or, you know, talking to somebody, or this and that. But we're all sitting there like this. Yeah, we're so happy. Why? Because that shanti, that depth of shanti is contagious. You're so contagious. And when your mind isn't asking anyone to be anything, you're just free to enjoy your own being, then you're... Whatever's coming out of your eyes, whatever's ever coming out of your being, is just shanti. It's just ananda, you know. And so that's very contagious. Even when one of us are happy or full, and looking say somebody is looking at you with so much love, you know, even though it's not about you, but you are totally received. It's like that person knows you. You feel that person, talking about my experience with Swamiji, that person knows you better than you even know yourself. You know? And sees who's really there. You know? I think that's such a big thing. I was thinking, that's why, you know, when we used to go in to see Swamiji, and I'm sure all of you probably had this experience, you go in to see Swamiji, your teacher, and you have a whole list of questions, really important ones, really important questions, the things you really want to deal with and work out, you know. But then I would walk in with my list, you know, things that are really important for me to talk about, and I finally get a chance to really sit down and go over these things, and I'd sit there, and then I would totally forget the list, because it was irrelevant. The list becomes irrelevant. Right? When that ananda is there, your list is meaningless. And so then you have to write down your list. Because you know that you're going to forget your list when you go in there. Mm-hmm. I used to do that. Write down the list, because I know I'll go in an altered state when I'm with him. So I'll write down the list, so we can smilingly talk about it. That's so good. So ridiculous.
Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.